We both do, in fact, stand up and have legs. That's the first time we've met in person. Yeah. He's going to say a few words, and then he's going to take questions, and really it's your session at 10:30.
Perfect. Morning, everybody. Hope you're feeling all good now because you've had your breakfast rolls and you're all good to go. I've had Danish pastries, which is really nice, so I'm really pleased to be here. I joined the council on the 1st of March this year, so I'm relatively new to the council. However, I live in the county and I have two children, both of whom have had education, health and care plans. So I understand both personally and professionally some of the issues and challenges that parents and families face in Buckinghamshire. But I'm very, very keen to have a conversation with you about some of the issues that you potentially face and how we as an education department can work with you to be able to support some of those arrangements. So that's what I wanted to cover. But I thought it'd be quite useful to start with a little bit of the plans that we have for our future. So at the moment, one of the things that we're doing in the council is looking at ways in which we can work more closely with organisations, with schools and with families and carers. And I really want to be able to extend that opportunity to Fat Bucks parents, to other parents and families right across the county, because I think it's really important that whilst we're all busy beavering away doing the work that needs to be done, to hear directly from children, young people and also from parents and families, I think is the most valuable way that we can make sure that whatever services we are looking to deliver are delivered in the best possible way that meets the needs of our children, young people and families. So you'll all hear things like co-production and all those kind of terminologies that are kind of bandied around, but it really is a commitment from our department for us to work in partnership with parents and families and children, young people. And we know that we won't always hear some of the nice messages back from parents and families. But what we want is a real, true, honest conversation with people. And as we're going to get it, good. So as this session unfolds and the conversations begin, I genuinely want to be able to hear from all of you. But what I want to also just make very clear is that this is not the council working against parents and families and children and people. I'm representing the council as the Director of Education and Inclusion, but we want to work closely with parents and families and children and young people. So this should be around a way in which we can collaborate and work in a more integrated way. And I think I've heard different conversations that cite the way in which the council has worked previously in a perhaps a different way to what we want to work in the future. So I just hope you hold on to that as well, because like I say, from the conversation, I'm very happy to hear warts and all how things are working or otherwise. But I also want to just place on record that as far as we're concerned, this is the beginning of a conversation we should be taking forward in any case. And I absolutely want to make sure where you've got concerns, where things are not working effectively, where there are particular challenges from a financial point of view, let's have all those on the table and then let's think about what we can do to be able to move some of that work forward. The overarching structure of some of this work that we are planning to deliver across Buckinghamshire, so that's not the council, this is the council, working with our health partners, working with FactBucks, working with a whole range of different partners and organisations, including parents and carers and children and people, is going to be placed in our new SEND strategy. And some of us might think, well, that's great, there's a new document being produced, what does that really mean for me and my families and my children? What the SEND strategy is looking to do, it's first of all, it is a strategy for Buckinghamshire. So it's not the council's strategy or the health department strategy, it is for the council. And in its construction, we have sought the views of partners, we've sought the views of parents and carers, and we've sought the views of children and young people as well. And I think that in itself is a clear commitment in terms of the direction of travel for us as we move forward. Caroline Hart is here and has worked very closely with a range of different organisations, again to ensure that there is appropriate representation within the strategy, and it sets out our vision collectively for what we want for children, young people, and for parents and carers of children with SEND. and that includes myself as a resident of Buckinghamshire, who have two children with education health and care plans myself. So personally and professionally, I am invested in wanting to make sure that our system can be as good as it can be for our children, young people, and us as families. But I also need to be realistic too in terms of the financial challenges that we are facing. And I want to get that on the table first, because that might help us all to understand some of the issues that we are facing. So I'll start with the fact that in terms of the money that comes in from central government to deliver services for children and young people with SEND, the money that comes in to the council is paid through the Dedicated Schools Grant. And there are four blocks of funding that comes in to the council to do with education. And that funding is paid as part of what's called the high needs block. You're probably very familiar with all of this. If you aren't, then I'm happy to take conversations or questions as we go through. But the high needs block that we receive is the funding that is attached to children, young people to access education, that funds the provision as part of the education, health and care plan, as well as contributions from health. So there are a number of different issues that we are dealing with day to day. And if I'm sitting here, I'm going to sit here honestly and say to you that the funding we receive as part of the high needs block is nowhere near sufficient to be able to meet the needs of the children and young people in Buckinghamshire. And one of the things that we have done, it's all right for me sitting here, and it's all right for me going into meetings and whinging about it, but we've done something about it. So we have written to the new government, we've written to the Secretary of State. The letter has come from Martin Tett, who is the leader of the council, and we have written to Bridget Phillipson to say that we are concerned with the level of funding that we receive here in Buckinghamshire. It's not enough, and it doesn't meet the needs of our children and people. We also know that at the same time that we've raised those issues in relation to the high needs block, is that the funding we receive for other parts of the system, so the health funding we receive, the funding we receive from other parts of the system, is also under considerable strain. So funding is a major issue, but it's not the only thing that we need to think about in terms of addressing the way in which we work to meet the needs of children and people with SEND. Sometimes it's hearts and minds. Sometimes it's about pooling resources. Sometimes it's about just working more creatively and innovatively. But I have to be realistic and say that the pressure we are facing from a financial point of view, and I know this because I'm involved in weekly monitoring of the budget situation. And for some of you that join and watch cabinet meetings at home or on your laptop or on your phone or whatever else, the quarter one position, so at the end of June of this year, we haven't even got anywhere near through the year, and we were already £6.8 million overspent in terms of the high needs block. We're approaching the end of quarter two, and that figure, £6.8 million, is worsening, very significantly worsening. Hence the reason why we have written from the Leader of the Council to the Secretary of State for Education to set out and raise our concerns. If that figure continues in the way that it has at the moment, it's the sort of thing that could potentially tip any local authority into a bankrupt position. And what that means is that the council has to submit what's called a Section 114 notice, which is effectively saying we're spending more than we're receiving by way of grant. They don't use the terminology bankruptcy, but in our language, it means the council is bankrupt. Now, we don't want to be in that situation because that has implications for every other part of the system, every other service that we're responsible for, of which there are hundreds of services we're responsible for. So we have got to act in order to be able to manage some of those particular challenges. Raising the issue at the highest level with government is one thing. What we've also done is invited all of the MPs across Buckinghamshire to join us so that they can raise the issue in the Houses of Parliament as well. And I've had regular contact with a number of MPs who often write to me, because we as residents will reach out to the MP to say, there are challenges, there are concerns, can you help me, help navigate this system? And so I will have regular dialogue with MPs. But what I want the MPs to do on our behalf, our collective behalf, is to raise those concerns in the Houses of Parliament. And that's the plan for what we're going to do to tackle these particular issues. At the same time, the biggest issue that we're facing here in Buckinghamshire is that we do not have sufficient places for children to be able to access the education that they need in this county. Say it again. Yeah, we don't. And so I agree with your response and your reflection. And is it okay for us to have children accessing provision in Oxfordshire, Hertfordshire, Londonborough of Hillingdon, and wherever else? I will say to you that it isn't. How are those children, young people, developing friendship groups if they are bussed out of the county to be able to access their education?
And they're even less likely to do that when they're stuck at home without any provision at all.
Totally.
Which sadly also exists.
Totally. Totally. And the whole picture that we all know of is something that, as far as we're all concerned, isn't good enough to meet the needs of our children, young people. So I'm not going to sit here and defend any of the points that are happening, because I've already identified those issues, having walked through the door on the 1st of March and having looked at the provision that we have. I was clearly identifying those challenges from day one.
Why is it only now that we're being informed about this huge spending crisis that appears to be the fault of SEND, when we've all been saying for years these problems exist? Why hasn't there been a public admission of the crisis financially that the council are in? And why hasn't there been an asking of government before it got to this point? Because you've known this is coming for years. We've all known this was coming.
But it's all pinned on sharp-elbowed middle-class parents and the demand that we were creating, rather than the local government association and its members actually taking on their government. It feels political.
Yeah. Well, all I can say to you is that we have identified the financial situation up until this particular financial year. The figure, I'll come back to you in a second, the figure was nowhere near as severe as we find ourselves in now. Hence the reason why it was managed through the normal budget management processes. However, when we look at the increases of education, health and care needs assessments requests that we see come through, and we're now into 7,100 plus children with an education, health and care plan, and 11,500 children with SEND support, it doesn't really take a genius to work out that something's going to have to give. And I think at the same time that we have got, I'll come back to you in a sec, and at the same time that we've got these financial challenges, what I'm doing, sitting here with you today, as the Director of Education and Inclusion, is to give you that message so you've heard it in the same way that I have. But it means that I'm setting the conversation in the context of the fact that we, together, have got to do something about this. However, because there's no extra money available.
Can I ask then how you come that you've all just had 10% pay rise and Rachel, the CEO, is on £240,000 a year?
So I can say to you now, so I don't know where the 10% pay rise has come from, but that ain't a pay rise that has hit any of us that work in the local authority. And as for people's salaries, the salaries are paid commensurate with the level of responsibility, and you can look at that right across the whole of the country.
So she has more than the Prime Minister then?
I have no idea what the salaries are for people, because I know what my terms and conditions are. I happen not to know what people... But I think you can Google those yourself. I think the thing is, if you have particular issues in relation to officer salaries, then that's something you can raise through the normal complaints process.
£250,000 a year she's on?
I don't know about those things.
Can I just, because some people in the room aren't as knowledgeable about the higher needs block as other people, so in essence, the higher needs block, can you just very quickly say, you know, what specifically is spent on? Because it doesn't spend on the salary of the CEO of the council. So it It comes from the government to fund education, doesn't it?
It does.
What is it spent on? Can only be spent on.
Sure. So it's spent on education places.
Mainstream places.
Mainstream.
So it funds all the mainstream places. All,
so every child that goes to a school in Buckinghamshire, so 90,000 children, young
including
people.
Including academies. So yep. In essence, it comes through that process.
Through the ESFA. So that comes. Yeah. So it's not just the high needs block. It's the dedicated schools grant. There are four blocks. So there's the early years block, the schools block, the high needs block, and what's called the central school services block. So I won't bore you with a huge amount of detail. Central school services block is things like insurances and stuff like that, licences and all the stuff that's not that exciting. But yeah, it has to be paid. The early years block pays for all the early years provision for children in terms of their education entitlement, things like two-year-old funding, three- and four-year-old funding, etc. The high needs block pays for the provision for children with an education, health and care plan. And it meets the needs of children and young people in a range of different settings in order to be able to access their education entitlement. Early years block has elements of funding for children who have low-level emerging needs. So, for example, if you've got a young child in a day nursery and they can't access the curriculum because they need a walking frame or they need a standing frame or they need a table or whatever it happens to be, there is money within that block to be able to support the children to be able to access that provision as well. And then the wider block is the schools block, which effectively, for every pupil in the whole of the county, they are funded per place in a school. And so that money comes into the council and goes out to the schools. So effectively, we administer the dedicated schools grant as part of that process. That's how it works.
So one of the questions on our needs block then is education and healthcare plans, and what decision has been made recently doesn't impact that, does it? Because that's a statutory provision.
Yeah.
It's the non-education healthcare. So it's that which we call SEND support is the bit that's actually the conversation.
And I'll come back to that point, but there's some other questions I know that people wanted
to ask. I just wanted to bring everybody, because some people are very knowledgeable and other people aren't. Just
and that's
awareness that people are all at the same place.
That's hugely helpful. Thanks, Andrew. So in terms of the funding of provision for education, be that for children and young people with an education, health and care plan or not, be that for children and young people in a school with a SEND support, that funding all comes through the dedicated schools grant. So the funding for salaries, the funding for this, the funding for that sits outside of the money that comes in to provide an education for our children and young people. So whilst that might be a concern or an issue for some people, that isn't something we're in control of as part of the dedicated schools grant. Hope that makes that point really clear. There's also a question I know that's been asked about the fact that the removal of access to the high needs block for children without an education, health and care plan. And so that decision, bearing in mind that we have a £6.8 million overspend as at the end of quarter one, plus the worsening position that we're facing going up to the end of September, means that we have to spend the money that comes in from central government directly on the criteria that is set as part of the statutory provision for children and young people across the county. So, To try and simplify it, for every place that we fund statutorily, that comes from the high needs block. We have also, where possible, been using the high needs block to provide some additional financial support to schools for children who haven't got an education, health and care plan, but we know that their needs are likely to require an education, health and care plan in the future. However, because that's non-statutory, because of our financial position, we at the moment have had to pause the issue of that funding to schools and to settings and only look at cases on a case-by-case basis. So in the past, what would have happened, and I've worked in education for many years, I would have thought to myself, right, I've got two children in my class, both of whom I know do not have a diagnosis yet, do not have an education, health and care plan yet, but I know they're likely to need some additional support. So I'm going to make a request from the high needs block for some money to be able to support them whilst they're in the school. That request would be submitted to the council. The council would receive it and, where possible, would honour it by providing some resource. We're not in that space anymore, where we're at £6.8 million overspent and a worsening position heading towards quarter two, which now means that we're having to hone in the resource we have available to meet our statutory obligations. And then if there are particular individual cases that we are seeing or requests that are coming in, we are reviewing them and accepting them or otherwise on a case-by-case basis. That is the current situation that we're having to do. Whether we like it or whether we don't, that is the reality of what we're having to do because of the financial position that we face ourselves in and needing to meet our statutory requirements. So that's effectively what we've done. What we then plan to do, if the financial situation changes for the better, and I can see your hands and I will come back to you, if the financial position gets better or improves, is that we can go back to the way in which we have been working in the past and reissue the way in which it's been supportive in the past. But like our own bank accounts, if I go and I need to buy something and I've only got £50, that's what I can spend. I can't spend above my means. I have £50. And it's the same principle in relation to the money that we are responsible for in the high needs block. Obviously, it's not £50. It runs into a number of £148 million. So it's quite significant in terms of that funding. So that's the situation we find ourselves in. And nobody in this room, I don't think, would not understand the premise of, in terms of the budget management arrangements, to meet statutory requirements. And that's what we've had to do. So three hands I've seen, so I want to come to those hands.
There's also questions here, so I'll hear what questions come and then I'll also...
You can do that, yeah, great. So I think you were first, and I'll come to you then.
Thank you for the explanation. I can see how it works, and, there's a certain pot, etc. But I'm wondering how the council is going to deal with the ramifications of this decision in terms of hundreds of students who don't have any HCP but do need to send support, not now being able to get the support they need, which will likely lead to increased overwhelm and difficulties, dysregulation for those young children and young adults. That in turn is going to affect their attendance, it's going to affect their mental health. It's likely going to lead to a massive increase in EHCNA requests, which surely is more time, more staff, more money, more assessment. The cost-benefit analysis, I know you've had to make this decision, but the cost-benefit analysis seems backwards to me in that respect. So how is the council planning on meeting that increased demand? Because trust me, it's coming.
And the trouble is that that's at the same time as rhetoric from government and the local authorities on social media.
Attendance,
and we're making the schools more inclusive. Well, no, you're not making mainstream more inclusive.
So, I mean, obviously, what we're not able to do is flip the switch and it's all resolved. So, the first thing I'm saying to you as part of the strategy, which is 25 to 2030, is a 5-year plan. We are not going to sit in this room and walk out of here and it's resolved. I know that there are issues and I know that there are challenges, and I want to work with the system, including yourselves, to address those particular issues. The point about the...
8 years listening to the same...
Well, you're not with me, you haven't. Yeah. But one of the things... Well, my commitment is that we've set out on a strategy to be able to make improvements. And let's not have a them and us arrangement here. Let's do this in a collaborative way. I'll come to you in a second. We'll do this in a collaborative way. That's how I see we will be able to fix the system. Because if it's going to be the council versus the world, that's not going to be an appropriate way. And that's certainly not our commitment. What we want to do is to work collaboratively to be able to make this happen. So that's the reason why the strategy has been devised with parents and carers and children and young people and system leaders, rather than it being the council strategy that we just dish out to people and say, here you go.
So get the bit about the strategy and the forward looking and the inclusive schools bit, but the first part of the question was, are you prepared for the likely increase in assessment requests? lists.
Can I just,
and,
yeah.
Which is, you know, which is the downside of the reality of that funding situation, which you've explained very clearly. And so it's, are you aware of that? And can you assure, I think the one thing the parents want to know, that they won't become the blame for the request that will come because the schools now say we can't meet the need because we haven't got the provision because the council won't fund us. I think that would be a good question to answer.
So let me just make it really clear. So schools in the funding from the funding formula that's used for schools has a notional amount of funding for children with SEND support. So this is national. This is what happens across the.
But in reality, though.
No, but it does.
It does exist in reality. Consideration. So what you're saying is already in. Like, there are children who are requesting EHCP needs assessments already because there is no higher need block funding. And schools are saying, we cannot meet need because we don't have the funds. Mm. The government has squeezed the school's budget from every single
Absolutely.
Which way you
yep.
look. So that notional budget that you're talking about doesn't exist. Mm.
Well, can I just say, on a technical point,
technical,
it does.
Of course it does.
But it does.
It is like your big magic pot.
Yeah. Yeah, but the only thing I can say to you is that the funding formula that's used includes notional funding for children. So therefore, in theory, and I say the word in theory in inverted commas with an underline that goes with it, there should be sufficient funds to be able to meet the needs. Now, in reality, we know that's not to be the case. And when I'm dealing with and speaking to our head teachers across all the primary sector, all the secondary sector and special schools, I hear overwhelmingly the issues, which is the reason why we have written to the Secretary of State to set out our concerns, including the levels of funding that schools receive. So we've made the point very clear. But technically, from the funding we receive from central government, there should be sufficient funds to be able to meet the needs. And that's the challenge that we face. So I absolutely hear what you're saying. In response to that, we as a council have written directly to central government to raise our concerns. And what we want is a response back in order to see how that translates on the ground to be able to meet the needs of our children and people. But in the very short term, we have had to remove that funding because of the fact it's non-statutory. We're having to focus on statutory provision. And so let me just finish the question, because you're asking me a question. I haven't answered that before I come on to your next one. So what we want to do is to make sure that we are adequately supporting schools, the sector, parents and families and children and people in order that it is going to be longer term sufficient to be able to address those particular issues. And I absolutely hear that in the here and now, with the range of assessments that we are being requested to facilitate and to conduct, that is placing a tremendous strain on an already creaky system. And that's where we face the problems at the moment.
I know we come across angry and aggressive.
You're not angry at all. No, not at all.
I am.
I'm not seeing that.
What I wanted to say is that, as angry as I am, and as frustrated and all the rest of it, I feel a huge compassion for those within the SEND workforce who are trying to work with us and trying to fix things and know that things should be different and that decisions are being made unlawfully with the blanket policy.
But bear in mind,
some of the staff are just amazing, and I feel that the additional workload this is going to bring when they are already under immense pressure, under pressure on us, you simply can't imagine.
Yeah.
And I can only assume it's the same
with
your staff.
Can I just make the one point, though, just to underline and draw that part of the conversation to a close? Mm-hmm. That funding for children without an education, health and care plan is still being considered on a case-by-case basis. So if there are particular needs in particular schools with particular children, we are still reviewing. In fact, we've reviewed and awarded some grants this week. So it is still happening. But the blanket arrangement of being able to submit a request and receive the money has had to stop. But where there are needs, they are assessed now on an individual basis. That's the slight difference that we've seen previously. I'll come back to you, and I know that you had your hand up as well, so you're next.
Can I just have a question? Sorry, can I just chip in
piece of it, just because I think it might be helpful around there, is that whilst there is the note to the HMPF, there are inclusion advisors and kind of teams that are trying to support schools to support the needs of those young people. So there's been a kind of an upping of that end of it to try and enable schools to be able to support the children and young people that they are, you know, that these requests are coming through for. So I just wanted to draw it a little bit away from the money to the, but there is support going in there to try and support. So there's team up meetings which are going to be multidisciplinary with psychology, specialist teaching service, therapy, link work in there. So there is support that is trying to facilitate schools to better be able to manage. And I know it's not the full answer.
It's only about facilitating the training then. Why is it that most schools are allowed to restrain? Why are we still training them in team teach? Why aren't we going down the route of low arousal approach by Studio Absolutely. 3? Because that creates a lot of educational trauma for years.
So
why aren't we training them?
So we had an inclusion conference on, I think it was Tuesday this week, and we had our therapy service, we had speech and language, we had CAMS, the inclusion, they're called inclusion practitioners, I think they're called. And you know, a range of people there that were doing that whole, you know, this the sensory side of it, the communities were doing a sensory workshop, you know, the speech and language that we're talking about communication, to try and build those
it's skills. Not about that's
I know what you're saying about
that. It's the restraining, which is the issue. And they have it very neatly worded, if we feel they're at risk. Yeah. Well, what is the definition of that? They make that up as they go along. And it's up to them how they do it. And
most
schools are using Studio 3, which has reduced the amount of people who have needed to be restrained. So why aren't we working towards that, which would create a lot of a nicer environment for these children?
I think I would say in a kind of theory way, that is the way we want to go. I think it's just that it takes a while to get there. So very much at the moment we're saying to the needs, we've got a range of people out there, you know, professionals out there who are promoting that, what is the need, rather than going, actually let's intervene and restrain, actually what is the need, what is that behaviour communicating, and actually trying to get a bit more of that in there. It's, you know, it's not a quick win, it's not something we're going to be able to change, but, you know, none of us are in school all the time in order to be able to go, actually should be doing that. But I just kind of want them to
should promote applied behaviour analysis and positive behaviour support. Why do you promote that?
I think that's a very good question. We come to that to you later. We come to PBS. I bet we will come to PBS. Kelly's had her hand up for a long time.
And also the ladies.
We sit on our knees, we don't get on the stuff.
My question to you is, if you're so much in debt, the local authorities are so much debt, why do you then proceed to waste money going through tribunals and things when you're majorly wasting money, when obviously there is a need there? What's the answer to that? Because the more tribunals you're going down that route, or other things we're fighting for, it's
which
then wasting money. I'm more
expensive.
How the hell
do
you make 3% loss?
You wouldn't do this, you wouldn't let your church, you know, this is, you can't do that. We had one question, so Kelly's asked a question, I think Michael needs to be able to answer it about tribunals, but, you know, why does the council still fight tribunals? I think it's a very fair question, so why do you continue to fight tribunals when, on the whole, most tribunals are lost by the local authority?
Sadly, the very fact we actually have tribunals in the first place is a concern and is a worry. Our ambition would be to have a resolution before we even get to the point of a tribunal. That is obviously our aim. In reality, it is our aim.
It's not.
I can tell you that it is. So we can have an exchange back and forth. I can tell you that. But I can tell you that it is not our aim to enter into tribunals. So that is the point that I'm making.
I think the local authority need to look. It's not just tribunals, it's a whole.
Yeah.
So it's like social care, it's everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having to fight the system or argue the system when we know our children best,
yeah.
I think is absolutely disgusting,
yeah.
To be honest with
you. And I think that the point you're making about tribunals is, to go back to the point, is that should be the absolute very last resort. You know, we would want a resolution at the very first hurdle that we're hitting. Now, that would be the aim, but we also live in the real world in terms of the fact that there are differing expectations and all the other things that we have to manage. So I get all of those particular points. The fact is it something we want to go into to have tribunals? No. Do we want to spend already overspent resources having to go through legal processes? No, we don't.
But
we have no choice when a tribunal is requested to actually go through that process, because otherwise, from a court perspective, we're also then penalised in that regard as well. So it is important. It's important for us. But it's important for us.
It's a question that's not about a land use block. Because there are some questions here, for example, about EOTAS, for example,
yep.
The lack of PFA in certain people's plans over the age of 18, which are all, you know, other subjects which you might want to touch on.
Yeah, sure. So, I'm going to go to this lady on this table who's been waiting really patiently. Yeah.
I'm Claire Smith-Tingley at Buxton Service.
Hello.
I just wanted to check, so I think what we're talking about, so it is about home support. But there's, send support in schools. Schools already funded for send support in schools. So what we're talking about with the planning block decision is about when they make a request for additional funding.
That's right, yeah, because the notional funding is already paid.
Because
yeah.
I've found it it can come across as there's no funding for any SEN support in schools. That's the point I
wanted
to make.
And to kind of underline that point, as I mentioned, technically, whether we think it's the right amount of money or not, schools are funded for notional funding to be able to meet needs. That is the theory, but what we know is that that is placing a pressure on schools, which is the reason why we're raising those issues at ministerial level to be able to address those particular points. But thank you for making that point.
So actually, on the, when you've written to the government, is there a time you would want to reply by?
Well, we would have liked a reply by now, because we wrote 2 weeks ago, right at the beginning of term, to say, here are our concerns. This is our financial position. This is where we're at. We haven't yet had a response, or at least we didn't have one as of yesterday, but we'll be following it up. And bearing in mind, I have fortnightly meetings with the Department for Education, and I also have monthly meetings with Ofsted, and I'll be raising those concerns with Ofsted and with the Department for Education in relation to the fact we've written to the Department and we're still awaiting a response. And as I say, it's not been me as just the director sending a letter off. This has come from the leader of the council.
Yeah,
one would expect that there would be a response to that letter, so we're waiting for that to come in.
And then on the thing about schools, like you're saying, them providing the care to children who don't have an EHCP,
yep.
Why do they make it so hard?
Yeah.
Several schools, I know my children in special education from when we touched,
yep.
So I've had to fight that.
Yep.
So many people I know, even now, my kids are 15 and 16, still in the same position when I only people with the same position, they're not getting an HCP yet. The school does not do the basic things, it won't even cost them any money. Why is that?
I don't know that. I don't know, and it's frustrating to hear, because in my conversations with all education leaders across
the country, they don't know what they're doing, but they're not.
But and I don't know whether you've raised concerns about that, whether you've made formal complaints about that, but one of the things that I would want to encourage is that there is a dialogue between parents and schools in relation to that issue, because, as we've just mentioned, we want the very best education for our children and people. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And whatever we can do to try and facilitate that and to be able to make that happen is a conversation we need to have. But where there are particular examples of where that is not working as well and or as effectively as we would like to see it, please do let me know, because I do have those conversations with Siri. I do have those conversations with head teachers, and I'm very happy to raise those on your behalf as well.
I think so, because, you know, I use the example of talk to people, if a child break their leg, that school, we bend over backwards, and that's 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So have the child in the school, there's lessons upstairs and they live, they teach them downstairs, they're sitting in front of the class. But with children like ours, they just don't do it. Very simple things, which are about a lot of money,
Yeah.
There's so many children that are suffering.
And those reasonable adjustments, exactly. As far as I'm concerned, you're not asking for the world. You're just asking for a reasonable adjustment.
Why so.
And I don't know that. I can't answer that, but I can answer. I can follow it up as appropriate. So I come to you, then I come back to you.
So it feels like there's a divide. It's like we're blaming the schools, but ultimately, reasonable adjustments can only be made to so many children. Because if we've got 10 children in this class with 10 needs, they can only adjust the learning to so many. Then if you've got a child that full-time education isn't appropriate for, why are we forced to send our children? So I have a daughter that would have benefited just doing English and maths. But I'm going to be in trouble by the school and the council if I don't send her full time. There was nothing left for her other than me educating her at home or pushing her into school, where she then becomes, you know, she's anxiety promoting. All these other problems. So then my next option was to get an EHCP for her, which is at cost to you. When really, she needed to have her English and maths because when she left school, she went to college full time, everything was fine. School was her problem. Nothing the school did, they couldn't have adjusted anything to help her. It was not the right place for her. But had she been able to go do her English and maths and then get onto the course she wanted, we'd have had a lot of, you know, an easier time for her, but her attendance constantly asked about her attendance, constantly felt like I was being punished because the school was at the right place for her. I could have applied for the HCP and she would have got one. But she didn't need one because she could have coped with just the English.
Just different
if
adjustments.
She she'd already come out with English and maths and not be sensible. So why would I need to push her for full time education? At cost to you, at cost to her mental health, she just needed that bit of time. College, she's gone there, she's done 2 years of college, she's come out with all of the grades that she needed. It was just school. But you don't have anywhere in the council that I can go and speak to without being penalised or fined. And then it becomes me against the school, I'm telling the school you're not doing enough for her. It's not the school's fault. They haven't got the money to sit there and constantly, you know, do what she needs. Because if a load of other children, some schools don't even have an LSA in class. They've got one teacher, 30 children. In year two,
I'm trying to differentiate that kind of teaching and learning. I know, because I've been there, so it's
so
incredibly challenging. So,
the support of they were being pushed into the full-time education. A lot of children just need a year or two to calm down, do the CAMS. You can't have CAMS in her, and then you're provoking them by putting them in education all day. Then you go to CAMS in the evening, they're already anxious. The CBT doesn't work because they're too anxious. A nice break without being penalised or fined, you know, and
And I think the point you make, I absolutely understand. And I think on an individualised basis, we would absolutely want to be able to support that. The difficulty is across central government policy is that it's nationally applied. And therefore, councils have to apply those standards because we in Buckinghamshire can't say, well, we know what the national policy is, but we're going to do it this way. We have to follow national policy as well. So some of the challenges in relation to differentiation that you're talking about in terms of teaching and learning or looking at individualised approaches in terms of what would be best suitable for your daughter compared to the other 29 children in the class, all of those kind of things do raise issues and challenges at a system level to be able to implement appropriately and equitably across the piece, which is the reason why we find ourselves in the challenge we have. And I think from an attendance point of view, clearly we have to ensure that children are in school where they can be, because it is absolutely prevalent in terms of, there's a correlation between educational attainment and being in school. And we know that last year, for example, there was 1,160 children in this county for whom they were absent from school for no other reason other than the fact they were absent from school, not because they had health needs or other needs, absent from school for more than 50% of the time. Now, if at the end of the GCSE results, at Key Stage 4, they don't get the GCSE results, parents are going to be saying, so what's happened to my children's education? Well, I can tell you the reason why. Your child has not been in school. And that is the issue that nationally is applied in relation to that approach. I don't know what order is. On Teams, it's so much easier. You've got a number, haven't you? But I think it's over to you next.
So I'd like to understand how you said earlier, it's not a them and us approach, as in local authority and parents. And it can't be like that because of the situation we find us in. However, the local authority peddles that narrative, I'm afraid, of a them and us, by persistently and consistently providing illegal narratives when they're dealing with parents. So, for example, a child not in school needing alternative provision. oh, local authority is stating that child can't have any support with alternative provision until they've got a draft DHC plan.
Mm.
It's the school's responsibility. Schools are then saying, we haven't got the funding to do this.
Mm.
You're withdrawing, but like you're literally acting illegally across the board through all of the processes. So from the first instance of requesting a needs assessment, through the complaints processes that you tell us we should be following, when nobody responds within standardised timelines because everybody is so overwhelmed, that when you get a statutory assessment, everything is going over the 20 weeks. And then when your child, by this point, is so broken they can't attend school and you end up on an IOTAS provision, you've been through the tribunal because you have no other choice, at a cost of 2 years, and then 9 months later, to go full circle and end up fighting again. This is across the board. So many parents in Buckinghamshire are experiencing the same thing, yet your staff are sat there peddling illegal narratives time after time after time and just saying, it's okay that we don't meet the 20-week criteria, we've got no EPs, I'm sorry about that. Actually, no, you have a legal responsibility.
Well, we have a statutory responsibility, and I absolutely hear what you're saying. The target that's set for education, health and care plan compliance within 20 weeks is, as far as I'm concerned, should be 100%. But the target that's set nationally is nowhere near 100%.
So we are aiming to go where on that?
To get to 100%. So we, at the moment, are at 51% of the numbers of education, health and care plans that are completed. If we compare that across the rest of the region, we are not, as far as I'm concerned, that is nowhere near good enough. But if we compare it with other local authorities in our region are in single digits of percentage for the completion.
But we here, and you represent.
Yeah. You probably haven't heard what I've just said. Our aim should be for 100%. But the reality is that our completion rate currently is at 51% of children and young people completing a 20-week process as part of the education health care plan. That's not good enough. That's not good enough. But the reality is, taking your point about capacity, I think somebody mentioned, we have got 7,000 plus children with education, health and care plans, plus all the annual reviews that need to be completed, plus we have all the assessments, but all those are done by schools. So all of those processes should... Of course, well, there are always going to be exceptions to those rules, and those children with EOTAS packages are fewer compared to the majority of children with education, health and care plans. But the reality is, we should be aiming for 100%. That's the aim. It shouldn't be at 50% or 40%. It should be 100%. The reality is, it is impossible for us to get to that particular place because of the sheer numbers of requests that we are having to deal with. And I'm not making an excuse. I'm not making an excuse. I'm telling you factually, this is what we're dealing with. So it's no point me sitting here and being defensive to the points that have been made. I'm trying to be as honest as I can be with you in relation to the situation. This is where we find ourselves. What we want to try and do is get to 100% for obvious reasons. The reality is we can't always do that.
But factually, if you're working factually, your staff within the ISEN department are actually peddling illegal narratives the whole way through.
Yes.
You know, how do you propose to change that? Because that's not creating a co-productive relationship. I would love to be able to talk to my ECHO, and I would love to be able to have a call. And I worked through the send resolution team system through tribunal with a beautiful co-productive relationship. So this isn't me. However, you take that away and you put somebody back in with an ECHO who has no experience of the law, and just they make it up as they go along. It's just constantly made up.
Well, I'm sorry that you've had you and others have had some negative experiences. Not everything that happens across Buckinghamshire is negative. I will want to point out there are some positives.
I'm interviewing because I
realised
that I promised Michael
we'd
be
aware
of us
here. It's okay. I can stay
to
11.
Okay. All right. But I think you have experience of lots of people, but over the total, the reality is that because of the way the numbers go, There is a part of people for whom it isn't what you described, and you know, so it's not everybody. It's not everybody has.
I would ask
experience.
You to sit in the grass.
I can sit in the grass group, and I can sit in lots of groups, but I can stand here in this room and categorically tell it's not 100% because it is not true. Because I know people for whom it's not true, and I think that sometimes. Absolutely, the issues are significant and people are impacted, but we have to also, the bit that Alison was saying, is recognise that a lot of people in the system work really hard to make things happen in a positive way.
I'm not disputing that.
And I think, I think that you know, it's important that we don't, as parents, keep painting the whole system as being black and everybody as being bad, because otherwise we get ourselves... I'm coming to the end of my tenure, so we're very close to the point where I actually can speak the truth about me. You have no idea. None of you have any idea. I'm sorry, I've had a lot of that over the years. None of you have an idea of my experience. So don't quote back to me what I don't know, because I do. But that's not what I was trying to get across. I just want you to try to give an impression to the colleagues that we work with in the council that parents are here to work with.
That's not forthcoming.
We need to present that view so that Michael can take it away and go back to his colleagues and say,
I don't feel like doing that anymore. I'd be lucky if you wish to present that view on behalf of all parents and that you've represent.
Well, then the system won't work then.
But it's not working already.
The issue is a cultural one, isn't it? At its source, which is, I'm very pleased to hear you coming here today, Michael, and say that you wish to work more collaboratively and co-productively. But the reality is, at the minute, because of our lived experience,
we do not feel safe, there is no trauma, and we are in crisis. Yeah.
And that is exactly what...
A lot of people are in crisis. I'm sat here today, I'm just waiting for the council to potentially tell me that my son has been left neat again, in breach of, I cannot tell you how many statutory duties. So even when you get the golden ticket of the EHCP, you're still fighting. And legal threats are the only language, seemingly, that the council will respond to. And that is not a situation. I'm in a privileged situation, I feel, that I can go into more debt and get a loan to pay for a judicial review pre-action letter. I'm very well aware that that doesn't feel like a privilege, but I'm very well aware that is compared to a lot of other parents in my situation. And it shouldn't take
to
get statutory things that have been agreed in your EHCP delivered.
Yeah.
That's quite enough. Yeah. But why do we have to carry on?
Yeah.
And on that basis, it's very difficult to believe that co-production or any kind of relationship is possibly there.
But I think you've summed up the whole kind of key principle of what we're trying to achieve here. And I think that point around trust, partnership and collaboration, actions speak louder than words, don't they? And as far as I'm concerned, you know, I'm absolutely committed to opening up an opportunity so that we can actually do that together. And I'm also not going to sit here and hide behind not sharing figures with you, because you need to understand the financial context in which we're operating in. And I think from that point of view, having an open dialogue where we can share the concerns that we have, but also think about ways in which we can build some resolutions together, is absolutely the approach that I would like to see happening. But I 100% agree, because bearing in mind, as Andrew just mentioned, I'm also a parent and a resident of children with education, health and care plans in this county. And I also want to ensure that for my children and for 90 other thousand children in the county, we do the very best we possibly can. It is not always going to be perfect, because we can't do that, but we'll aim for as high as we possibly can, and that's a commitment we need to make. But actions do speak louder than words.
And that cultural thing is important, because Caroline Merritt is not here. She was due to be here. She has COVID. And yesterday in the meeting, which she was at, because she was online, and you were just yesterday, the parents' support groups meeting, that she said she recognised that the cultural change which she is trying to enact, which is that the individuals are thought of in individual work, is not necessarily getting down within her whole team. And she reflects
that. She's the one making the other
people accuse me of not telling people things all the time. So that was that about culture. So what she asked to do was for instances to be fed back to her of when those things have not been that culture that Michael's talking about. And Michael is another person. I mean, I'm sure he will say, let me know if that happens, because I want to say that we need to work with staff training. You can't just, you must encourage staff to change and train them, and I'm sure the council's got lots of works and ways of doing that. But that is an important, they recognise that culturally things take time. We were talking this morning, weren't we, that 10 years after Senate forms, the reality is it's going to take another 10 years, because culture takes a long time to change. And schools are like that. Some schools have changed, some schools are different, there are different schools, and lots haven't. You look at the statistics, our own statistics, the parent response. You know, 1/3 of the parents say their children enjoy school. 3/4 of us say that the schools are welcoming to say that 1/4 aren't, and 2/3 are unhappy, for example. So, you know, so there is some good there, but there is also a lot that needs to change. And I think that's the work Caroline's talking about, trying to get schools to change. But that isn't actually, in the end, Michael has no power over schools. That's the one thing I always try to remember, is the director of education in the old days, 30 years ago, could have told the head teacher what to do, and now that doesn't work, and it really requires head teachers and leadership.
Why does that give two children at school? Because the SEN officers haven't done their job correctly. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't comprehend when my daughter went into supported living. They knew in April she was going into supported living in Bedfordshire, because surprise, surprise, there's nothing in Buckinghamshire. So she's had to go to Bedfordshire. They couldn't comprehend that they needed to sign off and then send it to Bedfordshire. It took for me to contact Bedfordshire and Bedfordshire to contact Bucks. And then go, oh, we're really sorry, we didn't know until the 19th of July that she was moving. But actually, no, you did know. You just chose to ignore it. So now my daughter couldn't start college last week because Bucks haven't sent the correct paperwork over. And my son's out as well. So why am I... So now I've got my 9th tribunal, and if hers isn't done, I'll have to do a 10th one with her. And it shouldn't be like that. The SEN officer should have known this is the process.
Yeah.
If somebody's moving out of county.
And as Andrew mentioned, where there are very specific systemic issues like the one that you're painting, I would like to know, because then I can work with colleagues to look at ways in which we can find some resolutions for them. You know, I can't sit here and say everything's rosy, because I know for a fact it isn't. Far from it. But there are still...
It's hard to work with social care as well, though, yep. Because there seems to be this massive divide where you can't really communicate between each other, even though you send emails to each other. It's still a massive divide.
And we want to ensure that, again, from an infrastructure coordination point of view, those things don't get in the way, because we're one children's services department, so we should be able to make that happen.
But I've been supported, well, she's 23, so we've been supported by the social care side of it, and things have been put in place. It's the education side which
has
let us down.
Right, and that's the part that's frustrating to hear. So, again, please do, I mean, Andrew, you've got my contact details. Phil, you've got my contact details. Please do share them with people. I'm very happy to be contacted directly. I have quite a heavy inbox anyway from contacts from people that email me, and I'm very happy for that to be the case.
Can I just ask a question on work with transport this year?
Sure.
16 children.
Yeah.
Well, why was it such a debacle? It's awful.
Yeah.
Now, I was in a position this year, my son turned 16.
Mm-hmm.
2.5 weeks of that taxi to Hillingdon, as you said, and the person around here for him. Next year, I have two children in that position. Am I supposed to transport two children in a woman to pick them up to a taxi sorted out? Absolutely not. Why should I know this education?
Yeah, the homeschool trials.
Can I ask why that part wasn't caught up when the government changed education to the age of 18?
I think we're talking very philosophically there in terms of those kind of issues. I think in terms of homeschool transport, absolutely hear what you're saying. And I think we know, because we were working until...
I know Rachel spoke about it.
So we were working quite late to address some of those particular issues. I think the thing is, We all know that post-16, let's face facts, is always going to be more challenging than regular school. Precisely. But unfortunately, the eligibility has to be confirmed, and then you've got the issue of the fact that you've exactly answered the question. So you have a situation whereby you've got a young person going to college who says, I'm making it up, I'm going to go to Bucks U College Group, that's the course I'm going to be doing. They enrol on the Saturday, often, or whenever the enrolment day happens to be. Then their timetable changes because they've said, oh, actually, I don't want to do that course now, I want to do this course. So trying to have transport, no excuse, just fact, trying to arrange transport for the very next week is nay on impossible, because the commissioning arrangements need to take place with the operators to be able to have those in place. Say it again, sorry.
What about the very many people likely in this room, and certainly amongst the community,
Yeah. The applications is probably different to the actual provision of the taxi, transport, or otherwise. Yeah, again, because it's so changeable. So if the council then says, I've got 50 applications here for young people, it's more than that, but 50 applications for young people, and they want this, and this to be in place, then your young people go to college and enrol, and it's, no, I don't want that. I'm now doing a Tuesday afternoon and a Thursday morning, or whatever it happens to be. So therefore, the arrangements are always going to be impacted from post-16. I've worked in a number of councils, including across London, and I can tell you now, post-16 provision will always be more challenging to be able to arrange. For very... Yeah, they do. And I think there's work that we do with a range of... So, for example, the post-16 provision for September 25, we are now planning now for that to happen, because we know the young people that are going to go on to those. So that's the work we're doing. So we're already trying to bring the date forward so we've got more effective systems in place. And our homeschool transport team that sits in a different part of our world is also working with our education colleagues to be able to make that a smoother arrangement. But even when we get to a point where we get to August the 31st of next year, before colleges commence in September, there is still likely to be some changes for some students in relation to the provision that they actually need. But on the whole, where it is feasible, we will want to be able to make sure it's a smoother transition. And that's the reality of what we're dealing with.
Sorry, can I interrupt you? I met with Transport yesterday. There was a change in system this year. Determining eligibility for SEM transport is being moved from the transport team into the ISEM team. In theory, and you know, I have some sympathy with this, that might make things more efficient in the long run. There was a second thing happened this year, which is that the local authority, in order to spend their money more wisely, shall we say, felt that there was some kids who were going into post 16 who maybe could manage without transport, but were getting it automatically.
Yes.
So they decided to impose a system of checking everybody's eligibility, which in the past they never did. This was not worked out properly, and then caused more stress than should have happened.
Yes. And big delays.
And the transport team and ISEM team have accepted that. And it shouldn't happen again because it was a change of system. Michael's probably trying to defend his
staff. Can I just add to that? In my particular son's case, the local authority also, within that process, decided to illegally remove transport-related needs from my son's plan in order to suit their narrative that he couldn't use, that he could use public transport. So, you know, yes, there are lots of things that the ISEM team have done which are regrettable.
But just on that point of post-16 transport, though, one of the things that I think we absolutely need to do is, you know, we've got a work stream that you've heard about in terms of the Delivering Better Value programme. One of those work stream areas is around preparing for adulthood. Providing a taxi, providing transport for every young person in this county is not necessary at all. And I think what we have seen is a continuum of provision from a child or young person from reception right the way through to when they finish a post-16 provision with no reviews along the way. Now that, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm glad you're all agreeing, is damaging for preparing a young person for adulthood, because how are we actually expecting our young people to be independent if we're just transporting them from A to B? It's not effective at all. Where a child or young person requires transport, absolutely, we should be putting those things in place.
I think that we get the impression that Michael could be here until tomorrow.
I'd like to be. I'd like to come for a whole day, if possible. I really would.
We have a bit of statutory business we have to do, and we have other guests we've invited, and we did say we'd stop on time, so I think we'll have to draw this to a close. We've let you run on. I'm being told off in the corner, but that's life. There is a series of questions which you haven't got to, which I know you'll provide. We will work on, make sure there's answers to, we'll let those know. I think I'm getting the impression that there's a general desire to go on some of that dialogue. Our new communications lead is looking at having Facebook Lives as a regular event, and I assume you'll be happy to be part of that and go on some of these conversations. I think that's important. I'm going to stop it now because I say the time is, we've run on 25 minutes and we ought to try and finish on time. So thank you very much, Michael.
Pleasure. But can I just say, Andrew, yes. though, just, it, I mean, I know we've had a slightly elongated session than we had planned. I would like it to be double the length so we can really go through some of the issues. But I'd also like to think about ways in which we can engage with some of the plans that we're doing and look at that genuine collaboration piece, because I'm not sitting here saying these words and going out of here and thinking, right, I've done with that. What I want to do is have that conversation and think about how we can take the strategy, the vision, the ideas and implement them on the ground. And that starts with action speaking louder than words. That's what I'd like to see happen.
I had to put in a call again last week, suing you all. I was made to pay for my son's taxi up front because he was on the hiatus. And I've not been paid. I've put in complaints, still not been paid. So what have I done? Served you with papers. Now you've got court fees failed.
Again, I think there's a lot of system issues. Our finance officer could talk about the council's finances.
Thank you very much, Michael, for your time. My pleasure.
The original idea was to do the AGM and then have a break. I think that there's been quite a lot. So if people would like to get themselves a quick drink, we'll have 5 minutes of break, then we'll do the AGM. I should shorten it as much as I can so that we can get to the commissioning team.
I found places to share a lot more accommodating.
Thank you.